Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with Barry Till of the Art Gallery of Greater Victoria, all the way in Canada. We're talking about their exhibition, Modernization in Meiji Japan, which goes on until August 28th. Still in the process of lining up sponsors for Let's Talk Art with Brooke, but in the meantime, if you'd like to support the podcast, please look for my book, Reptiles on Caffeine, on Amazon. Enjoy the podcast.
Okay, the Meiji period is a period which lasts from 1868 until 1912, mm-hmm. and it's when the emperor who became known as the Meiji Emperor was restored to power. The emperors had lost power in Japan way back in the late 12th century, mm-hmm. when the shoguns were set up. They were the military power. Mm-hmm. And then at that time, the emperors more or less just became figureheads. Okay. And they were allowed to stay in Kyoto with very little power. So from that time until 1868, the emperors had very little power. Now, Japan began to modernize, and that's partly why he was brought back to power. There's one incident which really caused the fall of the shogun before the Meiji Emperor, and that was the arrival of an American captain named Commodore Perry. Mm-hmm. And he showed up in Japan in 1853. Mm-hmm. And he showed up for the purpose of opening up Japan's markets ports, because there were some Americans who were whalers, and their ships had been shipwrecked, or they put into Japanese ports to try and get food and supplies, and were either killed or pushed back out to sea. Now, the reason for this goes back a little bit further, back into the 1630s, when Japan decided it was going to close itself off to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. As a result of this, they missed out on the Industrial Revolution and all sorts of things which were happening around the world. The reason why they decided to cut their nation off from foreign powers was because the Spanish, Portuguese, and English were making great inroads with Christianity into Japan, and the Japanese shoguns did not trust them, so they decided to close off the country except for one small spot, and that was a little island off of Nagasaki called the Shima. Mm-hmm. And there they allowed two foreign nations to trade with them, and one being China, because they were right next door, mm-hmm. and the other one being the Dutch. Uh-huh. And the reason why the Dutch were chosen is because they weren't overly religious, mm-hmm. And therefore they felt they could trust them. So the Dutch had this exclusive monopoly with trade with the Japanese, and they brought all sorts of great treasures to Europe. Uh-huh. So finally, with them having the only connection with Japan, as I said, they were missing out on all sorts of things that were happening around the rest of the world. Uh-huh. They didn't allow any other Japanese to travel out of the country. So therefore, it was a very insular nation. It became very futile, but they developed beautiful art and beautiful literature at this time, and they always looked upon the Edo or Tokugawa shogun period as being one of the bright spots in Japanese culture, but they fell behind. So when Commodore Perry came in 1853, he forced Japan to open up. And Japan would open up, and that would eventually bring about the downfall of the shoguns, mm-hmm. because they realized they couldn't do anything with the Americans with their big warships. The Japanese had no technology that could compete, so they basically had little boats, and they could approach these gigantic boats, even steamboats, with huge guns. So they realized that they were more or less impotent in fighting with any foreign powers. Mm-hmm. So they decided, first let's get rid of the shogun, which they did, and then placed the Meiji Emperor in power. And he came to power at the age of 15, and in the next 45 years or so, Japan would go from a backward feudal nation to one of the world's great military powers. Mm-hmm. And it's because the new emperor coming in wanted to modernize his nation as fast as possible. So everything foreign seemed to be what he wanted. So he was inviting foreign experts to come to Japan to upgrade everything. And he was also sending the best students of Japan back to other places. For example, he was sending young students to Britain to study their naval system because the British had the best navy in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He sent students to Germany or Prussia to study their army because they had the best army.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent students to France because they had the best banking system. He would send students to America, United States, because they had the best commercial system.
Mm-hmm.
So all these people were going there, learning these new ideas and coming back. So Japan would rapidly change in a matter of roughly 45 years. Everything was changed.
Right.
And they felt everything, they needed to westernize. And so they adapted Western clothing, Western attitudes. They adapted a constitution. Everything was changed. Everybody was being affected.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see the prints that we have up, you just see all sorts of things. The emperor's now dressed as a foreign leader. He's dressed in a military outfit. His wife is in Western costume.
Mm-hmm.
Even his carriage now looks like that you'd find in England with the time of Queen Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
They went from having palanquins, these sedan chairs, to now royal chariots with all sorts of people going by in military outfits. Everything was becoming westernized. They were adopting things like Western music. So there's violins, cellos, and other things showing up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a major change in society from all sorts of aspects. So it was, they actually became very interested in American baseball.
Oh, wow.
eventually take over the national sport from sumo wrestling.
Uh-huh.
And they also would have racing, polo games, and we have Prince showing the emperor watching the polo matches and the horse racing. Again, this didn't exist in Japan before this time. So as you can see, all sorts of things are changing. And then architecture began changing as well. They realized that they were, all their buildings, which were largely made of wood, including their buildings and bridges, and they're very prone to fire and earthquakes, and therefore they can be wiped out. The city of Tokyo suffered major losses in the 19th century when it came to these things. So they invited British architects in. They began building with bricks and also with stone blocks. So you suddenly see in these prints these stone bridges and these cast iron bridges as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're now changing because this is the modernization, and there's just huge numbers of British people coming in, architects building these buildings. And the prints that I've got up, 30 years earlier, they would have been straw huts, basically, with thatched roofs. Now you've got Western-style buildings, several stories.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing which was changing was the transportation. In the past, during the time of the shoguns, they would only allow people to ride on horseback, take these sedan chairs or palanquins or ox carts. They had no horse carriages, or you would simply walk. Now, suddenly, you've got new things coming in, like bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the rickshaw, which was invented by the Japanese in 1870.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was spread to the rest of Asia, but the Japanese were the first to introduce the rickshaw. And it spread very quickly, and eventually the Japanese were the first also to outlaw it because it was making their streets so slow.
Mm-hmm.
So in our pictures, in our prints, we have hot air balloons. We also have a lot of steam engines.
Right.
The Japanese invited the British to come in and build a railway, help build a railway, and then we have a print which actually shows the very first inaugural run from Tokyo to Yokohama.
Mm-hmm.
And you have British engineers, and they would take the emperor to Yokohama in 55 minutes. Unfortunately, they're trying to show off, and they sped it up too quickly, and they arrived in 22 minutes, more than half an hour earlier.
Yeah.
And they were in big trouble because instead of being praised, they hadn't got the red carpet out yet for the emperor.
Right.
It caused some embarrassment, so they were arrested, and basically they were lucky to get out of there with their lives, because even though they tried to do to show off a bit, it they didn't follow the right protocol.
It backfired on them.
Yeah. we've got sorry, you're breaking up again.
Sorry. I was just saying it backfired on them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And they had Yeah, we've got about 15 or 20 of the railway engines, and in some cases the artist didn't fully understand how to depict them, and some of the wheels are squarish, and sometimes they got two steam track headed very rapidly towards each other, so they didn't fully understand. It was something new to them, but you have to realize that in the 1870s, this is all new to them. If you go back 20 years, they didn't have any of these things. And we also have a number of steamships which were suddenly showing up in Japan and being copied. And so all this is brand new to them. It must have been a tremendous shock in those days to see your country transformed literally overnight into something that you're not familiar with.
Right.
And as I said, it affected just about everybody in Japan. What else can I say? The streets, if you look at the streets, they're filled with double-decker, in some cases, these carriages mm-hmm. being pulled by horses on rails. So in other words, the trolley cars, horse-drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing all sorts of neat things from that aspect as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we continue on and we see great changes in technology. There's actually a Japanese man who was called the Edison of Japan, who was making all sorts of inventions as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the beginning of sort of family companies like Mitsui, who are setting up these big companies with their logo on it, and they're mm-hmm. the Western style buildings, so they would last right into modern times.
Mm-hmm.
So Japan was changing from a society which had samurai at the top, peasants as a second class because they provided the food, tradesmen as a third class people, the people who built things like furniture and homes, and on the bottom class was the wealthiest people of all, the merchants. But during the Meiji period, the merchants were getting so wealthy that they were bringing in vast amounts of money, and they were sort of bringing about the change. And you can really see it in the prints. In the past, the prints had showed things like kabuki and wrestlers and courtesans. Now they're showing Japan changing rapidly. So when you come into this exhibition, we have about 120 prints up. You see all sorts of how Japan just changed. I would have liked to have had a parallel exhibition next to it, just with prints 50 years earlier,
right.
Showing how Japan had changed so quickly and overwhelmingly. Everything had to be changed, and that's what the emperor was pushing, that we have to change in order to catch up. We're signing too many treaties with these foreign powers, and we're not, we could be left behind, because they saw what was happening in the rest of Asia with Britain taking India, Hong Kong, with France taking Southeast Asia, and with the Germans and Russians and the other powers taking advantage of China. So they didn't want to be caught in that situation. So they modernized, whereas China did not.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually there were the Japanese realizing these great powers have all got colonies. Maybe we should think of that too, because we're natural resource poor.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're going to do now then is we're going to set up our own colonies. So they would instigate a war with China. They would eventually succeed in taking Taiwan and other places. Now, what happened is the war started in 1894 to 95.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese had modernized their navy, having studied the British. They modernized their military, having studied the Germans. So when they showed up against the Chinese, their navy was backward.
Mm-hmm.
Their military ability was backward. The Japanese were very successful. And in a lot of the prints, we see the Japanese using their prints as propaganda, and you see them with their modern boats fighting the Chinese boats, which are quite backward. So it was propaganda, and it was just showing the Japanese winning victory after victory. And in many ways, they did, because nobody thought that little Japan would be able to defeat such a big nation as China.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing that happened was Japan modernized and China did not. And therefore, it was the war was relatively over quickly, in about 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese were able to take sort of ownership of Korea to a certain extent and get their influence in that, and Taiwan, and the Chinese had to provide them with a huge amount of war indemnities. Now, this didn't sit very well with the Europeans because they thought the Japanese were sort of sneaking in, getting all this stuff. So the Russians in particular, the Germans and the French, Japan had to get out of Korea. This upset them greatly because they had won the war. They felt they were justified in getting these trophies, if you will.
Right.
It would eventually lead to a war with Russia. In 1904, the Japanese were fed up with the Russians, but they also feared that they might have to fight, if they had a war, they'd have to fight the French and Germans along with the Russians. So Britain signed a treaty with the Japanese saying that if either Germany or France comes into the war, we will join with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So now Japan had one single enemy, and that was the Russians. And at that time, the Russians were one of the most powerful nations in the world, but they had one strong disadvantage. Their military was entirely in the West, in the European part.
Mm-hmm.
So they... as you know, Russia goes right across Asia. There was very little in the eastern part of Russia, so they had to bring their navy all the way to Asia. And because the Japanese had allied with the British were there telling the Japanese about everything. They wouldn't let the Russians use the Suez Canal. The Russians had to go all the way around the Horn of Africa.
Okay.
And, of course, South Africa was controlled by the British.
Nice.
They could tell the Japanese are on their way, and the British controlled India, they controlled Hong Kong, so they knew exactly when the Russian Navy would arrive. And after this huge long trip, the Japanese were waiting more or less in ambush, totally prepared for them, and they won the battle sunk a lot of Russian ships.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they had a few battles on land as well in a place called Port Arthur, and the Japanese were winning all day, so the Russians, having been one of the most powerful nations in the world, were rather shocked that this little Asian country that nobody had ever heard of was
right.
able to defeat them. It was a cause for national disgrace. It began the anti-feeling towards the Tsars. And some people said this was the beginning of resentment and then would probably be one of the early contributors to the Bolshevik Revolution, which
right.
would get rid of the Russian Tsars. So Japan played its part in that. Now, with these prints, we have all these war prints. We've got about 50 or 60 of them, which shows both the battle with the Chinese and with the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, it was used as propaganda, and there's only one or two prints where you'll see a Japanese soldier being wounded. In most cases, they are depicting their officers and soldiers in these heroic poses, fighting the enemy. And they're always dressed, especially when they're fighting the Chinese, they look like a European
mm-hmm.
fighting a Asian. In
mm-hmm.
other words, they're trying to show that they have modernized, that they are equal to Europe
to
now.
Europeans, yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting from that aspect. You can see with this art show the history of Japan during that particular period. And there are some mistakes that have been made, actually, which one of my favorite things is the Japanese made a lot of their people into heroes to get people to enlist and to be proud of the nation. They made one mistake in one case. There's one soldier, they're having trouble with this Chinese fortress, and one soldier actually climbed over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And got to the front gate and opened it.
Uh-huh.
And then the Japanese army was able to move and take the fortress.
Uh-huh.
But the problem was, and then they made several prints, they announced his name and thing. The one problem was they got the name wrong.
Oh, no.
And they made a soldier who was not a hero into a hero, and they told the real hero to keep his mouth shut because it would be a loss of face for the Japanese army. So the guy who was actually made into the hero would go around Japan at various theaters and list his exploits and how great he was, whereas the real true hero was forced to keep his mouth shut and work in a antique store with his father for the rest of his life.
Oh,
so,
no.
There's also some interesting stories attached with this. It's a fun exhibition because it really gives you an idea of the way the Japanese were thinking and how things were changing. Now, it's not a particularly proud period for the Japanese because it would eventually lead to the militarism which would lead up until to World War II.
Right.
So it is the militarization of Japan. It's an early period, but both early on, both Britain and U.S. were rather supportive of Japan because they were emerging as a major trading nation, and we have even some prints to show some of their industrial expositions and all the products the Japanese were producing at this time.
Mm-hmm.
They had awakened. They had become a world power literally overnight, and they wanted their place. And there are Russian propaganda posters which show both Britain and the U.S. helping the Japanese, and it shows them in a very negative light.
Right.
And it shows the brave Russian soldiers. So that it goes, you see propaganda art in both cases,
both
and
cases.
It's kind of neat to see that aspect as well. That,
yeah.
Because later on, of course, you know about propaganda posters with Hitler and Stalin and
yeah.
Mao.
Yeah.
So they serve their purpose, but they're
definitely.
Not always truthful. But
right.
Yeah. It was simply it's a fun show to do, just because there's so much there, and people suddenly can see how Japan just they changed and they became Western, and
right.
Over this they're very Western.
Right.
And this was the proof that started it.
Right. I think that's really cool. The Western influence just made them so much better, or
yeah.
so much better commercially.
There were some Americans who were actually coming, named Fenollosa, and some others as well, that were criticizing the Japanese for abandoning their culture. And
mm-hmm.
they sat down and were trying to persuade the Japanese, you've got to keep some aspects, like your ceramics, your lacquer work.
Right.
You have living national treasures here. You must try and preserve that. And the Japanese actually did listen. So there are certain aspects of their culture that did survive.
Right.
Because of Americans and British who were arriving saying, don't totally discard everything. You have some beautiful things in your culture. So
right.
Fortunately, there were people who were doing that.
Right, right. So what is your connection, what is your gallery's connection to Japan?
Well, we have what's considered the best Japanese collection in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And we started collecting early on. And actually, it was a San Francisco woman named Isabel Pollard who donated many of our early Japanese artifacts. And that got us going.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're considered the second most comprehensive Asian art collection in Canada.
Wow.
And we've had a lot of... And Victoria is the North America's closest city to the Far East.
Yeah,
so we've had Japanese immigrants, Chinese immigrants coming through this city first.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, Vancouver would become the larger center. We are on an island, which is next to Vancouver. It's called Vancouver Island, and we're the capital of the province.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have had a lot of connections with Asia, and we fortunately have a museum here, our art gallery, our museum,
mm-hmm.
Which has a huge, huge collection of Asian art, and it keeps growing. And shows like this, I should also point out, a huge number of these were collected in the last 10 years over the internet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because a lot of these prints, they can be bought for $29, $59, $149.
Uh-huh.
So you can build up a collection of these fairly quickly. And fortunately, I had some money that was given to me so I could be buying these.
Right.
And you can suddenly produce a good show. I've posted 180 prints from this period.
Wow.
But you can buy them for just a few thousand dollars, you know, and it's kind of fun to collect them.
Yeah,
and in most cases, you'll find that they're not worth copying. So in many cases, they are definitely genuine. So it's just a matter of searching them out.
Right, right. So I wanted to ask you, they're woodblock paintings, is that correct?
Woodblock prints.
How's that different than, I mean, obviously wood versus canvas, but I mean, like, how is that different in terms of, like, practical, like, just...
How it's made. It actually involves a team effort. You
mm-hmm.
have the artist who will do the first image. He'll do it in black and white, hand it over to the wood block carver. He'll carve out an image of it and send it back to the artist.
Mm-hmm.
He'll fill in the colors
mm-hmm.
and then send it back to the wood block carvers. Now, for every color, you're going to have a block.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So it could be 9, it could be 17. And so what you do is you do one at a time. You may have a run of about 500 or 1,000. You just do the reds, and then you put them on clotheslines or put them around your room and let them dry.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a few hours later, you can do a blue, and then you just do the blue. And they all have to line up these blocks. So, you know, in some cases, you're looking at, as I said, 17 blocks, which are being used. So they often use the piece of cherry wood on either side
uh-huh.
for a different color. And they have these certain guidelines called Kempo, and you have to align them perfectly so that the colors go into the right cells in the right area, and they can be quite exquisite. And so you have the artist who does the image, the woodblock artist who do the carving of the woodblocks, and then the printers. Uh-huh. And then you have a fourth group of people who are the distributors. So wow. It's basically a team effort involved.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. And you might have a very good artist, but the woodblock carvers aren't that good, so they may make a mess of it. You might have a very poor artist, but then the woodblock carvers can make it that much better, and the printers. So most of this art in the past in Japan was never appreciated. It was considered a vulgar art, mm-hmm. a low-class art, because you could be buying these woodblock prints for a few pennies. And even to show how much they disliked the prints, they often were even used as bubble wrap. When they were sending the ceramics to Europe, they'd roll them up and couple them up and send them off. And a lot of these Dutch sea captains liked them so much that they would flatten them out.
Yeah.
And then they began selling them. And guess who was influenced by the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists? People like Van Gogh, Cézanne, Monet, Manet, Whistler, Mary Cassatt, all these people were influenced by these woodblock prints. In fact, Van Gogh is known to have had a huge collection and made several copies of them as best he could, because they liked the different angles. They liked the large areas of sort of solid cover. The perspective wasn't always that good, but it was impressionistic, and that's what they liked about it. So the prints are really something that the Japanese literally made millions of them. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of different images that are out there. It's just it seems like it's endless when you go to study them. Right. And they cover everything. I found a print the other day which showed a Westerner cycling a penny farthing, you know, those bicycles with the big wheel at the front, to a Japanese park. So you can find all sorts of strange things. I found a print from the Meiji period which shows a watermelon contest where you throw them into the sea and then everybody competes to see how many they can get in their own boat. So you're dunking people too. So there's all sorts of weird and wonderful things that you see with their culture. And I've always been a big fan of Japanese woodblocks, because they just have so much visual history to them. And you see everything that you want to know about Japanese culture in them. And, you know, the courtesans, the people who frequented the brothels. You see the warriors, you see the landscapes, you see the people in processions, you see people going on just travel holidays. So there's everything you want to know about Japan is actually in the prints.
Yeah. So what is manga? And is that different than the wood blocks? Is that just...
That is, yeah. Those are paintings.
Okay.
And we have a show of manga now. And these are Japanese sort of intellectuals who wanted to be copying the Chinese style paintings, which mm-hmm. was known as the Southern School, and that's actually what manga means. It's Southern School paintings, or paintings
Southern
karate.
School.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Chinese were actually officials, literati, if you will,
uh-huh.
Who were amateur painters, and they just strove to enjoy painting, and they would never make the paintings for sale, but they made some very beautiful works of art. They weren't the academics, they weren't the professional painters.
Right.
So when some of these paintings arrived in Japan, the Japanese didn't have a literati class, so you find that all sorts of people were taking up the brush and learning Chinese so they could copy it.
Right.
So you had samurai who were doing some of the paintings. You had peasants. You had craftsmen. You even had merchants. So, but they all strove to be like the Chinese literati painters, because some of the most beautiful paintings in the world actually are literati paintings. So the ones we have and it's quite a good collection, are Japanese copying the Chinese tradition of literati.
Mm-hmm.
And we have one of the best collections in North America. There are very nice collections in L.A. and New Orleans and other places. But we sort of specialized in that very early, and we were able to get quite a good collection early on.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Now, did I understand you to say that you bought all the pieces that are in this exhibition?
No. A good portion of it. The majority, actually, I did.
Okay.
But we also had some collectors who I've been sort of pushing towards it, and they had also bought a number for us.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the show, though, I'd say 95% plus more would be purchased in the last 10 years.
Cool.
Either by me or some of the of our donors.
Yeah.
So it's a show that just simply materialized, because right now the internet has fortunately for us, driven down the price because so many of them are out there. They've caused the price to go down.
Right.
If I tried to do the show many years ago in the early 80s when I tried to be buying Japanese prints, they were much more expensive.
Right.
And now, if you're able to get them on the internet or find some of these auction houses, they go for very reasonable prices. And you don't have to have a big bankroll to be buying these. You can be buying them for, you could probably get a very good collection for $10,000 to $20,000. That's a large number of prints. Yeah.
Cool, cool. Well, that's awesome. Well, this was so interesting. I never heard of, I don't know much about Japan, but but
well, we're doing another show which is probably of interest to your. It's actually called Kinky. Ancient Chinese and Japanese erotic prints. And, there's a lot of Japanese prints which are erotic. I'm a shunga.
Uh-huh.
And they're overly erotic. In other words, they're very explicit, and they've exaggerated the private parts like three times or four times the size.
Wow!
But all great artists did this as a sideline too. They had the, you know, you have people like Hokusai who did the great movie, the most famous art object from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But on the side, he would do these erotic prints because he could make more money on this.
Money
bread and butter.
Yeah.
So even the great artists Hiroshiga, Utamaro, all were doing these erotic prints on the side. And it wasn't considered bad. It was just something
what they
did to make extra cash. So that this show will have about 60 or so Japanese prints, and then we also have a large number of Chinese erotic tiled ceramics.
Uh-huh.
So we will have those three shows up at the same time: the Nanga painters' paintings from Japan,
mm-hmm.
the Meiji prints from Japan, and then the some of the erotic prints from Japan. So.
Mm-hmm.
If you come in the late part of June, and you'll be able to see three shows.
Cool, cool. Well, is
we
there?
We rotate our shows all the time.
Nice, very cool. Is there like an age limit or anything for the erotic prints?
We will have signs if you are offended by sexually explicit content. Please do not come in. And in the past, when we did, we actually were doing it with curtains. I did the same, a similar show to this about 20 years ago, and we had curtains and we had the little black hat thing restricted to keep it over. But we will just simply have the signs here, and we'll just say it's not suitable. With the internet and everything, it's not as naughty as it was in the past.
Right.
And in most cases, when people come through these nowadays, they're laughing. And when I did it 20 years ago, I remember sitting outside the room listening to two elderly ladies who had gone in, and they were giggling and laughing all the way. So they're so extreme in depictions that they're more funny than offensive.
Right. Yeah, I think that's hilarious, and just that's. So yeah, I bet different times when you did this like 10 years ago, I'm sure the people had a very different reaction than what they do now.
Yeah. I think right now I don't know if there'll even be much attention to it at all. Although it's going to be on in this month, so we'll have to see how it goes.
Cool.
But there will be warnings.
Yeah. That's probably wise. Cool. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about this. I really appreciate it.
We change all the time, by the way, so about every 3 months you'll see new shows here. So,
okay.
And we have a large Asian component to our collection. So
usually there's
one or two Asian shows up that all the time.
Cool. Well, I will definitely keep up with it and follow you guys.
Okay.
We'll do it again for sure. Thank you so much to Barry Till of the Art Gallery of Greater Victoria for telling us about the Modernization of Meiji Japan exhibition. Thank you to you for listening. I know I learned a lot. If you're in the Greater Victoria area, check out the gallery. If you're interested in having us promote your product or service, if you have a comment, if you have ideas for future podcasts, or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com. That's all one word and Brooke with an E. Thanks for listening.
Let's Talk Art with Brooke is a Hotspur Enterprises media production.